You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Tracy Scott Wilson's play, The Good Negro, takes place in Birmingham, Alabama during the early years of the Civil Rights Movement, and it examines the personal toll the struggles took on the major participants. It's gotten great reviews, but you only have a limited time to see it because it's run at the Public Theater, scheduled to end on April 19th, unless it gets another extension. I'm very pleased to welcome Tracy Scott Wilson to our show today. Hi.
Hi.
And you must be pleased, whenever there's a play's run is extended because of popular demand, it has to make you feel good.
It feels really good. I'm really happy about the production.
The play opened not long after President Obama's inauguration, and Oscar Eustace, the artistic director of the Public Theater, included a note in the playbill that reads, "The timing of this play may not have been planned, but it's not a coincidence." Do you see this as a perfect time to examine just how we got to this point?
I think so. I mean, when I started writing it, I started researching the play about 10 years ago, and I actually started writing, putting pen to paper about 4 years ago. And honestly, I had never even heard of, you know, Barack Obama.
That's because you weren't listening to our show. He was on the show about 4 years ago.
Oh, there you go. I must have missed that show. And, you know, I could have never imagined that, you know, by the time this play came up, that we would have a black president. So it was just the coincidence was just amazing, and very, very happy coincidence as well.
Well, do you think people are looking at the civil rights movement in a different way since the election? What do you say to those who claim we're now in a post-racial era?
Yeah, I don't agree with that term at all. I don't even know exactly what it means. I think
racism is dead.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that a lot of people use that term to. And in order to escape talking about race, you know, in this country, it's sort of, okay, we have a black president. We don't have to talk about these problems. But the same, you know, while I'm very happy about Barack Obama, obviously, you know, the same problems still exist. And, you know, and racism still exists. And I just can't accept, you know, that we're a post-racial nation now just because we have an African-American president.
And one of the things you obviously wanted to talk about in this play, something that we'll see today, not just in the black community, but pretty much every community, is that they're not homogeneous, that there's a wide range of views, personalities, and that leads to all sorts of conflicts that go beyond the bigger conflict.
Exactly. I mean, you know, one of the things that the play tries to examine is that, you know, there's a lot of the class issues within race, and that's something that still exists and, it, you know, exists across the board. And so, you know, it's not homogeneous. It's not just one thing. Just because we have a black president, there's still so many different ideas and viewpoints out there and conflicts to be explored and talked about.
The play's main character is the Reverend James Lawrence, who's obviously modeled on the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Why did you want to create a fictional character based on him? Because I think that Martin Luther King probably would have given you an awful lot of interesting material in his own right. He was far from a saint.
No, I agree. But I think that when you sort of base someone on a historical character, you really get bogged down, especially on stage, and actors imitating the person and people's, you know, viewpoints about King. And I think people would bring a lot of baggage to it. So if we just have someone who's a complete new character, then they could just accept it for what it is and hear the play better, I think.
Well, watching the play, the audience begins to try to sort fact from fiction. For example, we assume that the Reverend Henry Evans, Lawrence's sidekick, is based on Ralph Abernathy, but then wonder, did Ralph Abernathy require so much maintenance?
According to the scholarship, he did.
Oh, so you did a lot of research?
Oh, yeah. I researched for about 10 years. I started writing plays about 12 years ago, and I knew I wanted to write a play about the Civil Rights Movement. I didn't think it would take me so long. But there was just so much scholarship out there about the movement. And, you know, a lot of my research, all my research sort of confirmed the fact that Abernathy, while he loved King and was very loyal, he was also incredibly jealous of him as well.
Is it I'm sure what one of your goals here was not to write something that was didactic. You wanted to write about human beings, and they just happened to be in this stressful time.
I think that's one of the things that I learned from reading all the scholarship, and one of the things I grew to admire about these people is that they were human beings, and that they were complicated human beings, and they had all these conflicts and personal problems, yet they still fought every day. Despite that, I think that when we see them as saints, that it minimizes what they did because it makes it seem easy, but it wasn't.
I also wondered about Bill Rutherford, the organizer who's just arrived from Geneva, Switzerland in the play. Is he modeled on a real figure or is he some kind of composite?
Well, he was actually named after a real figure and the personality is sort of my own. There was a William Rutherford who came from a black businessman from Europe who came to organize King's office 2 years before King was assassinated. So he... and Rutherford was sort of my way into the play because he was sort of an outsider coming in. And like I think most people in the audience, maybe having sort of a very idealistic view of the way things were working in the movement. And then quickly he sees how complicated things are.
The play opens as a young mother, Claudette Sullivan, is being arrested for taking her 4-year-old daughter into a whites-only restroom in a Birmingham department store. And I'm assuming that's something that would have only happened on rare occasion because black people in Birmingham would have known perfectly well that you don't go into the whites-only bathroom.
Oh, yeah, no, definitely. And her character is someone who is not someone who would do something like that. But as she explains later in the play, she just didn't. Usually what would happen in Birmingham is they would take their kids to the back alley to go to the bathroom. And, you know, it was a very humiliating experience for the children. And she just did not want her daughter to experience that. And it was a very spontaneous act on her part.
She's not, you're not somebody who thinks of herself as an activist.
No, not at all.
But she is the good Negro of your title, isn't she, as much as anybody? Because they're looking for a good Negro to use as a rallying point for a protest.
Yeah. During the play, during the course of the play, she is sort of the good Negro that they can, you know, use to hang the movement on. But as the play goes on, we sort of, that term becomes challenged. I mean, the whole idea of, you know, what is a good Negro becomes challenged.
And what would be a bad Negro in their eyes?
I think a bad Negro is probably her husband, who's Palsy Sullivan, who, you know, someone who's uneducated, who doesn't speak well, you know, he doesn't speak well, rather crude and rude. And someone who, you know, if the press would look at them and think, well, this is a stereotypical Negro. This is a, you know, someone who, you know, they don't talk well, they don't dress well. And, you know, that, you know, just on the outside is the bad Negro.
Although Pelzi makes some very good points of his own. But he and Claudette at first really resist any attempts to bring them into the movement. They're the sort of people who... to really just want to live in peace.
Yes, that's one of the things me and my director, Lisa Tommy, really wanted to examine was that how difficult it was during that time and that when you were doing something like this, you were actually taking your life in your hands and you were putting your life at risk, your friends' lives and your family. And we really wanted to show how difficult it was that, you know, people were living in terror, in absolute terror and fear every day of their lives, and to take something on like this was a huge step.
And then there are two FBI agents listening to Lawrence and Evans' every move. They have their room bugged, and they recruit a local good old boy, Gary Thomas Rowe Jr., to join the KKK and become an informant. How close is that to what the FBI was really doing at the time?
Well, Gary Thomas Rowe Jr. is actually based on a real Klansman, Gary Thomas Rowe Jr., who actually was a Klan informant working at the time. And he was involved in a very notorious case in the murder of Viola Luisa. He ended up testifying against the Klan during that case, but he was a Klan working undercover for the FBI for years.
And you get the feeling the FBI is less interested in protecting the civil rights leaders than, if anything, fomenting some violence between the Klan and the civil rights leaders.
That's right. The FBI wasn't interested in protecting the civil rights leaders at all. They were all they wanted to do is get information. And, you know, there was numerous incidents where, King was threatened and other leaders were threatened and they didn't tell them about it. They were not interested at all in protecting the movement. And, you know, a lot of the mythology seems to suggest that, especially that movie Mississippi Burning, but it's not true.
What they seem to be most intent on is proving that the minister had links to communists. And I know that Jade Goover was really looking for links with Martin Luther King and communists. The FBI agents are also privy to the minister's affairs with other women. They wound up sending a tape to Lawrence's wife, Corrine, and that's based on a real incident.
That is.
Coretta received this tape?
Exactly right. Right after King won the Nobel Peace Prize, Coretta was opening the mail, and she thought it was a tape of King's sermons. People used to send him the sermons in the mail, and she would file and save them. And it ended up being a tape of him having sex, along with a letter saying suggesting that King should kill himself because he was going to be exposed.
There are a lot of people who object to even discussing this part of Martin Luther King's life because it kind of makes him less heroic. Is it important for us to see this part of him as well?
I think so, because I actually think it makes him more heroic. Because, like I say, I think that showing that he had all of these problems and pressures and conflicts, yet he still every day selflessly fought for freedom, I think it's greatly admirable to show that. And also inspiring that, you know, we can make change as well.
The staging is very effective. Scenes between the FBI agents and Lawrence's crew are often share the stage, even though we know they're happening in different places. Was that the way you wrote it?
No, actually, that staging was my director, Lisa Tommy's idea. I just wrote scenes, the headings with, you know, Rutherford and Henry, or James and Henry and Rutherford. And
so you just assumed they'd be in different rooms and people might be listening in the next room.
Well, my only thing was to be absolutely no blackouts in between scenes, mm-hmm. at all. So, and the play moves pretty quickly, but, you know, Lisa, you know, sort of very ingeniously figured that, you know, the FBI was sort of an unseen presence throughout the play, so she had them constantly sort of there on stage and just sort of in the background constantly listening to this conversation. So you just get the sense that there's no privacy.
Well, I understand that this is the first play in a projected trilogy. So in the future plays, will you automatically conceive of them with similar kind of staging?
No, I want the other two plays in the trilogy to be very different stylistically and stage-wise.
Have you worked them out in your head?
Very little. I know that I want the next one to be about the Panthers and the one after that to be about African-Americans in the early 80s. When the whole civil rights struggle, there was a lot of identity crisis with the civil rights movement meant, and the rise of conservatism and Reagan.
Well, all three of these would be about identity crisis, wouldn't they?
I think so. I think that you know.
You could call it the Identity Crisis Trilogy.
You know, I may steal that actually. You know, it is about sort of black identity personally and, you know, politically, and how we see ourselves and how we are perceived by others.
Well, the interesting thing for me, I mean, among many other interesting things, was that the audience was a very integrated audience, to say the least. So these are issues that interest pretty much anyone who's interested in what's going on in the world or current theatergoers.
I really do think that people are ready to talk about race in a deeper way now in this country. I mean, some people, obviously, they want to talk about, you know, post-racial, but I think there are a lot of, I mean, judging from the audiences and people, you know, the talkbacks that we've had, people really want to speak about these different things, I think.
Do you think black people react differently to the play than the white members of the audience?
Definitely. I have to say, they definitely do. There is an enthusiasm, and especially during the scenes when they're in church, there's a real recognition, I think, of some of the characters that happens when there's a large African American audience.
Well, the church scenes are quite realistic, and I guess if you'd gotten them wrong, an African American audience might have spotted that right away, and just everything else would not have been believed.
I think that's exactly right. And we had one of our actors, J. Bernard Calloway, is from Alabama, and he has a family that is from full of preachers and. So he just brings an authenticity to it that is just, I think, really wonderful.
The play has been extended until April 19th at the Public. Are there any plans for a longer run?
I have plans. I don't know if the Public has plans, but I would love to see it extended more. The seats are really selling out, and audiences seem to really respond, so I'm very happy with it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Tracy Scott Wilson. Her play, The Good Negro, currently at the Public Theater in a run that's scheduled to end on April 19th. So you better run down to the Public to see it. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. Wonderful talking to you as well.